I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour has been with us before, but the last time it was concerning an essay that she had written, and now she has a whole book that explains this issue pretty thoroughly and very provocatively. Joan Williams is our guest. The book is White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. And as she writes, the book stems from a Harvard Business Review essay that was started on election night when she realized that Trump was about to win the presidency. A friend wrote, "My working class family expected Trump to win and for the most part are quite hopeful about his presidency. My professional class in-laws have written several emails about their immense grief over Clinton's loss. I found the difference in reactions astounding, and I think your article explains the reasons for it perfectly. I hope the book helps," and indeed it does. So our guest who is with us is, well, did I say her name already? Joan Williams is with us and has been here before. She is a distinguished professor of law at Hastings and Hastings Foundation at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. She's author of other books as well, What Works for Women, co-author of Unbending Gender, Why Family and Work Conflict and What to Do About It. This will, in conjunction with our last hour, I think, generate a lot of phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and you can find us there at K Dunn Show. Joan, hello. Great to have you on again, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Kathleen. Always delighted to be on your show.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I want to go back because I think that this is striking that you remember this incident, and obviously it stayed with you all your life. But you had this awakening of a class divide when you fell in love with a 16-year-old Italian guy. You came from a pretty elite kind of background. He came from a working class background. And what happened when you went to dinner at his parents' house?
Well, he actually, when I went to dinner at his house, this is one of my very first boyfriends, I asked after dinner how his parents had liked me, and his father said she looked at us like an effing anthropologist.
Whoa!
Using the word. I was so shocked. I mean,
I'll
that was one of the first times I'd ever heard of an adult using that nasty word. I was humiliated because it was so true. I probably had.
So you were so self-aware enough at that age to realize that it was true.
Yeah, it was, alas, true.
Yeah.
And for anyone who is really interested in understanding white working class people, one of the things to remember is that they have very sensitive antennae for condescension. One guy said in a book that I read, and I've read pretty much every ethnography of the white working class written since about 1975, he said you can always get another job, but you can't get your dignity back. And so the idea of maintaining personal dignity is it's profoundly important for every human being, but it's particularly important for these folks because they feel that often their jobs don't give them the dignity that they deserve.
Why is it? How did this happen? The working class feels, you write, totally forgotten. People who are poor are getting more assistance than they are. The elites in the country are doing just fine, thank you. How did we forget about the working class in this country? We just spent an hour with a New York Times reporter who went around the country interviewing young people who just graduated from high school, and many are from working class backgrounds, and they either decided not to go to college, or most of them just couldn't afford to do it. You know, it wasn't part of the family tradition, and it was just too hard to do that. We don't pay very much attention to all of these people or to the working class, and they really are the middle class in this country in many ways. Why has everything been ignored?
Well, I mean, even the language that we use, typically we talk about these people as working class, but then working class is also used kind of as a euphemism for the poor.
Yes.
So what language do we have to talk about these people in the middle? We really don't. We literally erase them by the way we construct our language. And I think, so this is really the middle 53% of Americans, neither rich nor poor, median income around $73,000. The median income of people who supported Trump in the primaries was about $75,000. So this is the group, and this is the group that delivered him the election in those Rust Belt states where the white working class trended for him. I think they voted for Trump because Trump said, hey, you're the forgotten people. And I think they feel forgotten because we forgot them. Mm-hmm. They used to be white working class men, race and gender intended, used to be really at the center of the social imagination in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s. And then the liberal imagination deflected off onto the kinds of groups that I've spent my entire career working for: women, people of color, poor people, LGBTQ. And the white working class became distinctly unfashionable. When the elites stop running through their heads what they think about people who they see as below them on the social scale, some pretty unattractive things happen. So the stereotypes of white working class men, for example, in the past 40 years of sitcoms have been very consistent.
Archie Bunker,
stupid, racist, kind of fat. Homer Simpson, kind of fat,
right.
Stupid. I mean, they're very consistent. And so for people whose personal dignity is very precious to them and whose isn't, those kinds of class affronts are very, very deeply felt. And they've been associated with the culture in general, but they've been more deeply associated with Democrats, who have been very deeply committed to equality for those kinds of groups and for environmentalism. I mean, in many elite circles, it's kind of not optional. You have to be you have to be pro-environment. You have to be pro-marriage equality. But being concerned with working-class whites is strictly optional, and the common attitude expressed, sometimes behind closed doors, sometimes right in the open, is that, you know, stupid, racist, sexist, mm-hmm. beneath our notice.
Mm-hmm. And yet these are the very people who do so many things for us. There are people who pick us up off the street if we've been injured. They're people who serve us. They're the people who do all the work that keeps machines going, the plumbers and the welders and people who work in factories and people and, who work really hard.
These are the people who make our daily lives possible.
Right.
These are the people who are the reason why I don't have breast cancer. These are the people who give you your mammogram. These are the people who, as you point out, do all those blue-collar jobs, but also they're the reason you can order a present for your daughter for her birthday because they're working at the call centers. So, and I think we used to have more of a tradition of respecting blue-collar jobs. Now, again, I think we should respect the dignity of all work. I think people sometimes say to me, oh, you've been so successful. And I say, oh, you know, whatever. And they go, but you deserve it. You've worked really hard. Mm-hmm. And I always say the same thing to them. I said, yeah, I have, but so do hotel housekeepers. I think we have to get more in touch with the dignity of work, no matter what your job is.
Mm-hmm. We need another Studs Terkel.
Yeah,
because he sure interviewed and elevated people. Let's talk about Donald Trump for just a moment, because you mentioned that these many working class people gave him a margin that he needed to become elected. I don't fully understand this, and I know you've written about this in the book, so I feel like I understand it better. But here's Donald Trump. I'm not sure how much money he's worth, but a lot of people believe he's worth a whole lot of money, and he's got these, you know, gold ceilings and a lot of money, a lot of businesses, a lot of deals going on all the time. Why wouldn't people in the, and I don't know what term you prefer. Do you prefer, I know that you had an argument with your editor about this, and you decided that it would be working class if you could call those in the privileged class the elites. Do you prefer working class or blue collar?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things to understand is that, and then white working class people, they tend to admire the truly wealthy.
Right.
They resent professionals, but they admire the truly wealthy.
I don't get it.
How does that make, it makes perfect sense, actually.
Okay, tell me.
Kathleen, who orders them around every day? It's some college kid who doesn't know crap about my job, but is perfectly willing to tell me how to do it. Who condescends to them when they go to the doctor, as if they're not going to understand, you know, and talks down to them? The teachers. I mean, the backlash against teachers' unions in Wisconsin.
I know.
I think can be related to the fact that there's a lot of class anger against teachers who, although they typically have modest salaries, are all college grads, and sometimes the college grad teachers, the white working class folks feel that they're condescended to by their kids' teachers, who assume they're stupid because they haven't graduated from college. Now, I'm not saying that, I mean, my brother's a high school teacher in a rural area of this country, so I'm not saying that this is, that the teachers always condescend to them, but there's a common blue-collar stereotype that we just talked about, that blue-collar people are less competent than professionals, and blue-collar people interact with professionals every single day, and that they, blue-collar people are, and these people, these women in pink collar or modest white collar jobs, they are order takers. Mm-hmm. Who's the order giver? These mm-hmm. are professionals. Mm-hmm. Whereas the rich kind of operate in the realm of fantasy. So when Trump goes on The Apprentice and says, "You're fired," well, I mean, that's like an attractive dream to an order taker. That's the dream of being an order giver. The other thing to remember is that there is a very big class culture gap between kind of ordinary life in the professional, what I call the professional managerial elite, like the top roughly 20%, and ordinary life for people in the broad, you know, middle 50%. These two ways of life are really different, and it goes down to things as basic as the role of talk. I mean, in the family I grew up in, the role of talk is really, really different than it is in my husband's blue-collar family. Talking things through, processing emotions, talking about intellectual life, all of that is very central to the family I grew up in. To my husband's family, they see the role of talk very, very differently. For example, if you have TV on at dinner, that's a very, very clear sign that you're in one of these middle-class families. My family would never think of
right.
that. We're supposed to be sitting around
exactly.
having intellectual, stimulating
right.
conversation.
right.
And so the idea of becoming a professional means you have to change something as basic in your life as the role of talk. And that's unattractive. That's why many people from blue-collar families do not want to become professionals. They think we're kind of, you know, self-important pencil pushers who spend our whole life in office politics. That it's not attractive to them. What they want to be is exactly the way they've always been, just with more money. And I think that's one of the reasons why Trump has been so successful at channeling them.
Mm. It's interesting, but you also have going on, are you still with us? We didn't lose you, did you? Did we?
No, I'm here.
Okay, good. You also have these very proud families who keep nice, tidy yards, who have
yeah.
family clothes and grandparents down the road and go to church and know what's ethical and what's not ethical.
Yeah.
So here you have them voting for somebody who really has some ethical liabilities here, who doesn't live the kind of, you know, family clothes, have the traditional kinds of values that so many blue-collar families have.
You got it. And evangelicals, I mean, one of the things I found most shocking about the election was how heavily the evangelicals trended for Trump. But then I think about it objectively. I mean, if I had to vote for somebody who I considered to be personally distasteful but was going to preserve abortion rights in the Supreme Court, I would vote for them in a flash.
Mm-hmm.
They did just the same, but in the opposite direction. And I think that what Donald Trump really represented to them is, first of all, he said, "I hear you feel forgotten. That was something nobody said for them in a really long time.
Right.
And I hear you want jobs. That's something nobody has said to them in a really long time. And he also, Donald Trump, although he, of course, started out with a tiny little $14 million loan from his daddy, he is not a working class guy, he has been condescended to by New York elite his entire life. He's a guy from Queens. And so the New York elites have turned up their noses at him. And I think one of the reasons he channels working class fury at the elites so effectively is that he feels it. He has felt condescended to by these same elites his entire life.
Oh, that's fascinating. Let's talk about jobs for a moment. You talk about how many people in the working class would like to make more money. They'd like to be rich, and a lot of people would. The working class, you write, of all races, has been asked to swallow a lot of economic pain while elites have focused on non-economic issues. This is the first generation in American history to experience lifetime downward mobility. This is a big thing compared with people their age a decade before. So where are the economic plans? So why don't the Democrats and the Republicans, nobody still is addressing this whole lot of economic pain that people in the middle are feeling?
Well, Donald Trump talked a great game during the election. He talked about jobs. He put jobs front and center. He talked about a big infrastructure program. Now, we haven't heard that much about that. But the disheartening thing for me as a Democrat is we haven't heard that much about that from Democrats either.
No, you're right.
The kind of accepted wisdom, both among Democrats and Republicans, has been that because of globalization, those blue-collar jobs are going, and they're gone forever. And that with automation, it's only going to get worse, period, end of report. And I think that that's why these people feel forgotten. And I think that, you know, Thomas Frank and what's the matter with Kansas, I don't think there's anything the matter with Kansas. I think they think both Democrats and Republicans have not stopped the hollowing out of the working class, and I think they think that for a very good reason. It's true. Now, if you look at Germany, it is not impossible to maintain good middle-skill jobs for people without college degrees in advanced industrialized economies. Germany has. We just haven't cared enough to do that. And I think that's why these people are very, very angry.
Mm-hmm. And talk about forgotten. There's a chapter in your book that deals with trade policy. Not a good idea to embrace a trade deal that's good for the country as a whole, but bad for people working in specific industries without providing for job training for people in those industries, which didn't happen, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you often hear, again, this has been both Democrats and Republicans saying these trade treaties are great for you as consumers. And that may be true, but being able to buy cheap socks is no guarantee for a decent job. And I personally think that the Trans-Pacific Trade Treaty and scrapping that was the most delicious and lavish gift we ever could have given to China. But I do think that we kind of get what we deserve as elites because we have embraced these trade treaties without providing serious revamping of the local economies in areas that have been eviscerated by the trade treaties. And I think partly this stems from the fact that job retraining programs have gotten a bit of a bad reputation because this gets a little policy wonky here, but bear with me.
It's all right.
Their success has been measured on how many people trained. That's not the right metric. We need to measure the success of those programs on how many people placed. If we did, they would be doing what they should do, which is work. There should be alliances between community colleges and local employers to identify the middle-skilled jobs that employers can't find people to fill, which is a very common situation, so that the community colleges can develop training programs, very specific certificate programs, honored by local employers, to give workers those skills so they can get jobs at those employers. That's what we should be doing.
Mm. Let's, before we go to phone calls, talk about how deep a problem this is and what is the genesis of it. Working class resentment of the poor.
You know, I think that political elites have fueled this working class resentment of
really?
The poor, because it, you know, it doesn't exist to the same extent in Europe. In the United States, it's been so difficult to pass social programs that we've tended to get them through by making them cheaper, by having them be means tested and tightly targeted to the poor. And that makes sense at some level, but it may make sense economically, but it sure doesn't make sense politically. Because what that means is that the poor are getting things like income support, child care support, health care, and people just one notch above are not getting those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so means-tested programs are a very fine way to pit the have-a-littles against the have-nots. And that's what's happened. There's a tremendous amount of anger against those programs that's fueled a tremendous amount of anger against the government. And I think those means-tested programs, sometimes they're important. I mean, I'm a pretty traditional Democrat. But where possible, we need universal social programs so we don't pit the have-a-littles against the have-nots.
Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. Our guest was with us a few months back when this was an essay, but now it's a really interesting book, White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. Professor Joan Williams is our guest, Distinguished Professor of Law and Hastings Foundation Chair at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. And we're welcoming phone calls for her. A couple lines are open if you'd like to weigh in on all of this. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. Let's go to phone calls. Kevin in Escanaba, our first caller for you. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad.
Good.
Show on the way home from work, and I work for an iron ore mine in Upper Michigan, and I normally vote Democrat for the most part, and that varies a little bit. This last time I did vote for Trump, and everybody thinks that I had a hard time voting for Hillary because, as far as I was concerned, she was part of the last Clinton regime, and those are the ones that give me NAFTA. And I have watched a lot of jobs go away, and I just could not bring myself to go back to that same thing. That's where I figured it was headed. I don't think Donald Trump is the answer by any means. Trust me. He's kind of making us look foolish, I think. So, anyway, that's kind of where...
Is there anybody who captures your fancy politically? Do you feel like anybody's speaking to your concerns, Kevin, or not?
No, I don't think so. It still feels like the top end is worried about them, and like your guest says, the bottom end, I got friends that are living off the system, and I work my tail off, mm-hmm. 7 days a week on swing shift, mm-hmm. which is a miserable living to do. But, I don't really have a problem with people being rich. I aspire to be that myself. And I figure as long as I work hard, I should have the opportunity to get there. That's the only way I see it.
What kind of shift do you work? Swing shift means what for you?
It's a 4-week rotation of afternoons, day shift, and night shift.
So, Kevin, those friends that you say are living off the system, are they on disability then, or what?
Yes, a couple. And, mm-hmm. They're friends, but I personally, if it was me, I'd still be doing something to work personally.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we've seen a real explosion in the number of men, particularly men in outside urban areas, on disability. And I think that many of those guys would, prefer to be working. I think if there were jobs that were suitable for non-college grads, or there were certificate programs where they could go for a modest cost to get retrained for a job, I think that many of them would prefer to be doing that. But I think Kevin, for someone who's working on 7 days a week on swing shift, it is kind of tough to look at other people and go like, oh, how does this make sense? They're not doing what I'm doing.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind going back to college. So I'm getting, I'm at 53 years old, and it's hard to try to change jobs. And I do plant maintenance is what I do, and the welder as well. It's
so
getting harder
skills.
To do this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, do you think if you could go to your local community college and have a certificate program that was much, much shorter than a four-year degree that would give you some concrete skills for a different job, do you think that would be attractive, or do you figure 53 years old kind of passing by?
Well, I'm not sure which direction I'd go, because the reality is I've always been really good with working with my hands, and I solve problems fairly well. And I've made a good living out of what I do. I'm not complaining about the money. I do really well, actually.
I think what I'm talking about, though, is not, you know, training you up for a knowledge job. You know, as a pencil pusher, I don't have any mechanical skills. Why should you have pencil pushing skills? I think we need to value a broader range of skills, but we're going to need a lot of people, even as we shift to automation. Those machines aren't going to take care of themselves. We're going to need people who can take care of the machines that are replacing some of these jobs, and those people are going to have the kind of skills you have, the kind I don't, like spatial skills, right, and some of those analytical skills.
The problems I see, too, are, they have run off all of our managers that knew anything. You know, generally speaking, at about 20, 25 years, people went from hourly into management for their last 5 to 10 years because they had all the knowledge and they knew how stuff worked. And now they've gotten rid of all those people, and everybody I work for has like 5, 6 years, and that's my manager right out of tech up in Michigan. And they don't, like you said, they don't really know anything. So, you know, I spend 2 years training them. They get a little knowledge, and then they ship them out, too.
Yeah. Oh, but why? Because it's cheaper to hire them, or what?
Exactly. Well, that's the only way I can see it.
Right.
I guess I can't verify that. I don't know what their salaries are, but I'm sure anybody that left our ranks and went up, they would have gone for a pay raise as opposed to, you know, they wouldn't go backwards.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, I hope you take pride in what you do, because you sure should. It's hard work, and you are one heck of a worker, it sounds like to me. But let's move into this bigger picture that you were talking about, Joan, too, that there will be more and more jobs that are automated. The whole workforce is going to be changing. Are there schools that are teaching the kinds of skills that Kevin would need if he wants to switch his skill set, or that people are going to be in need of when we have a lot of robots, when we have a whole different kind of work going on?
You know, I think that my favorite example is Long Beach City College here in California. Long Beach is the second largest port in the United States, and they employ 10,000 longshore workers. And they are moving to automation, so a lot of those jobs are disappearing.
Oh, my.
So what the Port Authority did in conjunction with Long Beach City College is they developed a certificate program to train those longshoremen to maintain the new machines that will be unloading the ships. That is our future. We're going to have a massive shift to automation.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be a lot of jobs lost. Are we just going to sit by passively again and say, oh, sorry?
Right.
Or are we going to provide affordable, family flexible schedule type certificate programs to train workers with who have the kind of skill set that Kevin has to not to be pencil pushers, but to apply that skill set in a new 21st mm-hmm. century context? That's what we need to do.
Kevin, thanks very much for your call. I'm so glad you called. Let's go to Don in Sherwood, is it? Are you in Hi, Don.
Hi. Yeah.
Hi.
Well, I definitely did not vote for Donald Trump, and I also didn't vote for Bernie. Well, as much as I liked Bernie, I just didn't think that he really had a surefire chance at winning. So I begrudgingly voted for Hillary Clinton. I guess my feeling was the Democrats just didn't put forth the strongest candidate. But I understand how and why Trump got elected. I consume a lot of media, and I don't agree with this, but I do think that his voters and supporters think that Trump is having a very successful presidency. His supporters and the people who voted for him seem to have, they did so precisely so that he could do what he's doing now. And it seems as though he's destroying everything. He was kind of the nuclear option of, I guess you'd call it disgust and loathing.
I'm going to steal that, Don. The nuclear option of disgust and loathing.
It, when the media and all who oppose him are filled with horror and outrage, and they think that's good. And I think that they are thinking, now you know what it's like for us to look back at Barack Obama with his Harvard education, his foreign name, and, you know, be filled with rage and hate for 8 years. So they seem to crave the crude, the dumbed down, the no-class expression of their rage, and wanted him to destroy the Obama legacy so badly that they didn't care if the whole country went up in flames. And that seems to be their version of, I guess you'd call it, patriotism. I don't know.
Joan.
Well, Don, I mean, I kind of agree and kind of disagree. I agree in the sense that I think that for many people, voting for Trump felt like a delicious poke in the eye of the elites, of like, you hate this guy, so I totally love him. Voting for him is like flinging mud in your eye, somebody wrote me and said, saying. So I think you're dead right there. But I think that that in many ways, they also, many Trump voters, and the quote that Kathleen started out with from my book, White Working Class, indicates this. Many Trump voters also voted for Trump in hope. They said, this is finally somebody talking about jobs, finally somebody treating me with respect, and I think he's going to deliver for me. Now, I'm a Democrat, as I said, pretty boring Democrat. I don't think Trump is going to deliver for them, but I think that those two things were going on. Partly it's they voted for Trump to fling mud in the eye of the elite, and partly they voted for Trump because he was talking about jobs, and that made them hopeful for the first time in quite a while.
Let's talk about the issue of race and the working class before we go back to phone calls. And you trace some of this back to the time right after the Civil War.
Indeed. I mean, after the Civil War, Southern planters had a very self-conscious strategy of driving a wedge between blacks and whites in the South, working class people, by what's called the wages of whiteness strategy. They communicated to the working class whites, well, you may not be like us, you may not be rich, but at least you're not black. And it was very, very open, very racist, very effective. My fear is that we're doing the same thing inadvertently now. That I think that there's a lot of anger against PC among the white working class. And again, I think it's understandable in many ways, because it's very un-PC to speak disrespectfully of women, of people of color, of immigrants, of LGBTQ. It's not against PC to speak disrespectfully of the white working class. And so I think the natural result of that is to make it feel, again, quite delicious, a way to poke the elite in the eye to violate all those PC norms. And so I think that inadvertently, sometimes we fuel the racism that we're then dismayed by. I think that's one important point. The other important point is, you know, is there racism swirling around in this mix? Yeah, there is. There's racism among the elite as well.
Sure.
I mean, I'm out here in Silicon Valley, and we are having all of these sexual harassment scandals by in the professional managerial elite. There's a lot of racism. But saying, I'm not going to listen to, for particularly for elite white people, to say, I'm not going to listen to the legitimate economic concerns of less elite white people because those other white people are racist, there's something off there.
Mm-hmm. Let's say, thanks, Don, so much for your call. David in Michigan is next. Hello, David.
I just got my Social Security earnings statement the other day. 1986, just over 15,000. Last year, 6,000. I had a computer operator job that got shipped over to India. Now I'm working part-time community action. That's another thing. So many programs, you get aid up to a certain point, you earn a dollar over, you get dropped. Mm-hmm. Why not have it so it's sliding scale? As you earn more, the less you get. It's not that hard. Just have a poverty level. Have, if you earn less than that, have the government make up a percentage. And the other guy earlier was saying the rich, he's not paying for. He is. Because in monopolistic programs, they could charge you more. And when you have monopolistic companies, they could pay less. I mean, what we need is break up some of these huge companies. And I was talking to a robotics person. He said within 20 years, 80% of the jobs can be automated. Finland is talking about a basic income they're going to give to people. I mean, why are you going to have the rich own the robots and then the rest of us starve?
Thank you, David, for your call. It is interesting. Yeah. I can't imagine this country doing that, having a basic income, but I know that it's being discussed in many other countries in the world.
You know, I think that rather than having a guaranteed annual income, which I agree, first of all, probably ain't going to happen in the U.S., I think what David wants is the same thing that Kevin and Don are saying, mm-hmm. is that they want a decent job, a decent full-time job with benefits. And I think David has put his finger on why we have fewer and fewer of those jobs. It's not because of, you know, the likes of me, a professor, actually, although we're getting a lot of the anger. It's because the very richest business of the business elite of this country is pocketing more and more and more of the productivity gains. And we all know the numbers that the average CEO used to earn. I can't remember the exact figures, but it's something like 40 times more than the average factory worker, and today it's more like 400. That's what's really happening. And so, I mean, it sounds policy wonky for David to be talking about antitrust policy, which is really what he's talking about, that we need, if we're going to rely on the market, we have to have a competitive market rather than allowing these monopolies. But I couldn't agree with you more, David. That's right.
When was the
you
last antitrust?
A full-time job.
Yeah.
And we deserve a competitive economy.
Well, when was the last time you can remember any major antitrust action in this country? It's sort of hard to remember.
Well, there's a lot of it going on in Europe, but I mean, fact is, under Democrats and under Republicans, there's been far too little of it. Although I must say, as a Democrat, there's more of it. There's more of it in Democratic administrations than there is now.
William sends this message on Facebook. I disagree that there's been a lack of discussion of class divide in the U.S. The past 8 years, all the Democrats have talked about is the victimization of various social classes in the U.S.
I think that they've talked about the 1%, that's for sure. They've talked about the victimization of the poor and immigrants, that's for sure. But what they haven't talked about is the huge and often angry class divide between the middle 50% of Americans and the top 20%. There's been very little discussion of that. And that's the class divide, in my view, that's driving American politics.
David, thanks so much for your call. Let's pause for a moment and return. Our guest this hour has been with us before, but now she has a book. Before it was an essay, now it's a whole book, and it's titled White Working Class Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. Joan Williams is our guest, distinguished professor of law, Hastings Foundation Chair at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. Our number is 800-486-8655, our email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on, I say this so much, and we're on Twitter at Kay Dunn Show. We'll return to you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Back to phone calls now for Joan Williams, and let's go to Dia in Burlington. Hi.
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 Tagging on to the caller, Don, I think that a lot of people who watch the mainstream news and don't, and maybe internet as well, but don't do any reading from reliable sources like newspapers, and I'm not saying there aren't reliable sources on the television, but, you know, just aren't really verifying their sources. And maybe not discussing with other people the concept that they're reading about. I heard a woman say to me this weekend, defending her vote for Trump, she said, and this was an educated person, she's a nurse at a teaching hospital in Milwaukee. She said, I can't believe, she used the word boob, I can't believe how he turned out to be as a president. He did so good on The Apprentice. And I just want to hear your guest response.
Okay, well, how did you respond to that, Dia?
I didn't know what to say because I said it's a reality show, but I'm sure that it has plenty of scripts.
Right.
Well, I mean, the other thing is all he had to do in The Apprentice is kind of strut around and fire people. That's very different than, the most chilling comment that Trump has made so far, and I'm not a Trump fan. I've been pretty open about that. Is, boy, healthcare is really complicated. Yes,
right.
Donald, healthcare is really complicated.
Right.
I hear what you're saying. One of the things that I have been wondering is the American electorate really less informed than prior electorates have been? Now, it's true. A lot of people don't go poring over newspapers and policy papers. That's very, very true. But has that ever been the case? I think one of the things that's very concrete is that we need to be teaching civics. When I was coming up, I was taught civics and the basics of the U.S. system and taught to be proud of some of the basics in the U.S. system from the time I was in about fourth or fifth grade. And then what happened is, and I was part of this, there was a wave called the New Social History, where a lot of us focused on women's history and people of color, and then later gay history. And that eventually has gotten taken down into the high school level. And so high school kids are very often taught, you know, everything the U.S. has done wrong, and there's a lot that we've done wrong, but a lot less about what we've done right and about how precious our institutions are and how fragile and how we need to be vigilant. Mm-hmm. And so I think simply reinstituting high school and grade school civics classes could play a very major role.
Absolutely. I was really struck by this NPR thing. I'm sure you heard about it. On Independence Day, they tweeted the Declaration of Independence, which is a part, has been for my 4th of July Day celebrations. We always read the Declaration of Independence. And there was this huge Twitter response from huge numbers of people saying, this is a revolt. This is calling for a revolution against Donald Trump. And people didn't realize it was the Declaration of Independence. You know, there are certain things that happen and you go, oh my gosh, we do need civics classes.
Well, and I think, you know, when Donald Trump was leading chants of lock her up about Hillary Clinton, you know, to me, that was a good indication of what we've lost by not teaching civics. To the idea that you would elect someone and they would lock up a political opponent, I mean, that's a tin can dictator. That's not the United States. And the fact that people didn't see that there was something truly off about that, I think that just shows you we have to go back. And, you know, our institutions are very flawed. They're invented by humans. Humans are flawed. But, you know, democracy is the worst form of government ever invented, except for all the others, as
right.
Churchill said.
Right. I want to talk about The Apprentice for just a moment, too. I feel in many ways I was really caught off guard by this whole election because, and I don't know if this is elitist to me, but of me, but I didn't know about The Apprentice. I never saw The Apprentice. You know, there's so many other things to, you know, Abraham Lincoln's around. There are all these books about him. There's poetry. There's a lot of music. There's so many other things to pay attention to. So do we have this viewing divide that's going on as well, that we don't have a common... We don't have Walter Cronkite anymore. We don't have, you know, the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times or the Milwaukee Sentinel and the Milwaukee Journal. We don't sit around and read the newspapers and discuss. All people did that. It wasn't an elite thing to do, I think. You watched the news. We did. And my family, it wasn't an elite family, and read the newspapers every day and talked about all of that.
I think people are still viewing a lot and reading a lot, but you're right. We're in our little echo chambers. And that's what's changed. I didn't think you could make me as nostalgic for Walter Cronkite as I currently
miss him.
Feel.
I miss him.
I mean, I think people... I mean, and I actually think that elites are in as airless and a bubble as, you know, working class people are in. The problem is that we have... this is the downside of the Internet and having, you know, hundreds of cable channels, that all of a sudden we're so lumped in all the time with people who think exactly as we do. And I don't think we have figured out as a country how to begin to bridge this divide. I mean, I've been thinking about it a lot. I think things like, you know, Twitter and YouTube have a lot of potential to begin to bridge this divide, and that's one thing I'm thinking about.
Thanks so much, Dia, for your call. Let's go to Gary in Merrill. Hi, Gary.
Yes, thank you. I think the Democratic Party, they did abandon the working class back in the late 70s, and they knew that the working class had no other place to go. And now what the Democratic Party is, they have the leftist people, Black Lives Matter, the New Black Party, Black Panther Party, and they do have the elites at colleges, the actors, and they don't speak to the working class America, and that's why we have Donald Trump, and he's going to run again, and he'll win again, because people are starting to see that the Democrats have nothing to offer but radicalism, and the majority of the people don't want it.
Joan.
I mean, most polls show that only about a quarter of Americans identify as liberal, much less radical. So I think that Gary has a point about that. But I mean, I'm a Democrat. I do not believe that Democrats have nothing to offer middle-class people. Democrats used to be the party of jobs. They used to be the party of economic opportunity for everybody, not having that be a coded word for only people of color, which is important, but economic opportunity. If you work hard, you can gain a middle-class life. That should be absolutely at the center of what Democrats stand for. Now, I mean, Gary's got his history right. It was in the 1970s that Democrats began to move away from that. And in many ways, what Democrats began to be more focused on are the kind of cultural values that are very, very central to my way of life here in the Left Coast in San Francisco. I share those cultural values. On the other hand, I think that it's really important for Democrats and elites to realize that those elite cultural values, they make sense in my life. They don't make sense in the lives of many other people. Mm. They have different cultural values. I need to respect their different cultural values. And if I want people in my coalition, I have to be talking about shared values. The shared value of, if you work hard, you can succeed. Now, that's a shared American
sure.
value a lot of people can coalesce around.
Absolutely, and it's a very important value. It's very important that be true.
Absolutely. And, I mean, among my crowd, in you know, we work hard. We work hard because we want a solid life. Why is this complicated? That's all that other people want.
Absolutely. So somebody, darn it, pay attention to that, right?
I do. I feel the Democrats are, there are some people who, I mean, there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party, I think, who are waking up and smelling the coffee. I think there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who also were deeply shocked that Donald Trump was the candidate. So I'm really hoping that thoughtful people across political persuasions will take this as a wake-up call.
Mm-hmm. Well, they sure will with health care on the line at the moment. We got a lot going on.
Yeah.
Joan Williams, thank you. A pleasure again to speak with you. Thanks.
Always a pleasure, Kathleen. I so much enjoy talking with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Joan Williams, her book is White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. And it's really interesting. She explains that many people have conflated working class with poor, but the working class is in fact the elusive, purportedly disappearing middle class. She writes about their values. She writes about why they feel forgotten. And she's crossed a lot of divides in her life as well. So she writes about her family. It's interesting. Thanks very much to Gretchen Brown for producing this hour. And thanks to Gretchen as well for on-air production. We'll be with you again on Lunes, Monday, for all things political.